Well, I'm going to start with a quotation. In the summer of 1939, I was on my way home from Palestine, where I've been Air Officer Commanding Palestine and Transjordan during one of the worst of the periodical rebellions resulting from the Anglo-Jewish controversy. I had had a busy year there, teaching the British Army the advantages and the rebels the effectiveness of air power. So that's how Arthur Harris, known as Butch in the Royal Air Force and to history as Bomber Harris, that's how he opens his 1947 wartime autobiography, Bomber Offensive. And his comments about the Anglo-Jewish-Arab controversy and air power both capture Britain's challenging mandate in pre-war Palestine and also challenge the conventional wisdom that in Maurice Dean's words, between 1918 and 1939, the RAF forgot how to support the army, and that the use of the RAF for military control in Palestine had ended in failure. Furthermore, Harris is supported by General John Dill. He's the general who had taken over command in Palestine from the Royal Air Force in 1936, and was later to be Chief of the Imperial General Staff. And he wrote in his official lessons report, "There are few engagements in which aircraft and troops did not work together in very close cooperation. So close, in fact, that combined action is probably a better description than air action. Practically every case of a successful attack on armed rebels resulted from the combined efforts of air and land forces. Air provided the commander with his principal weapon of offence." So notwithstanding Dill and Harris's praise, the literature on RAF operations in Palestine is sparse. The RAF's own concise history, which I'm in the process of rewriting, doesn't mention Palestine at all. And as the Air Historical Branch has identified elsewhere, the RAF's interwar imperial policing role has been subject to both inter-service rivalry and poor history. And air control, as it was called when the Air Ministry had military control of a region, was criticised by the War Office at the time and by many historians since as being a brutal form of military control, more akin to what Charles Caldwell wrote about in his book Small Wars in the Victorian era, and unlike the post-1919 development of British counterinsurgency, which was based on three broad principles: minimum force, civil-military cooperation, and tactical flexibility. So what Dill and Harris are saying goes against, if you like, the conventional wisdom of the RAF's air control, policy of air control, in the Middle East before the Second World War. And more generally, with regard to Army and RAF cooperation, what was then called air support and is now called air-land integration, the conventional wisdom is that Trenchard's prioritisation of strategic bombing and the costly experience of ground strafing on the Western Front during the First World War meant that the RAF in 1940 in France was unwilling to provide the army with close support when in contact with the enemy. If you ask any army officer, that's what they believe. So what I want to do in this talk is examine the utility of RAF air power during the revolt, as indicated by Dill and Harris, and to identify the advantages and effectiveness that Harris refers to in my title, and the close cooperation that made air the commander's principal weapon of offence. Furthermore, this paper goes beyond existing literature to identify the origin of the concept of air support in Palestine, given the RAF's supposed dislike of close support after the high losses of the First World War, and also its preference for interdiction and strategic bombing. And then given the controversy of RAF support to the army in France in 1940, or rather the lack of it, to have a look at what happened to the lessons identified from Palestine. But where I need to start is a bit of background about pre-war Palestine. And this is a picture of one of the streets in Jerusalem. So the Palestine mandate and RAF control. The RAF's responsibility for the military control of Palestine after 1922 stemmed from Winston Churchill's attempts to reduce military expenditure in the Middle East. Britain's interest in Palestine was strategic. Its post-1918 occupation of Palestine protected the Suez Canal, the air route to India, the Iraqi oil pipeline to Haifa and provided a naval base in the Eastern Mediterranean. And in 1921, Winston Churchill had engineered a League of Nations mandate for Palestine, which included the Balfour Declaration's promise of a homeland for Jews, who in 1918 represented only 7% of Palestine's population. But Churchill believed that Jewish enterprise would help develop the Palestinian economy for the benefit of all. Thus, Palestine differed fundamentally from the other British mandates in the Middle East because it introduced an unwanted settler community. And Arab demands were made constant throughout the mandate to recognise that Palestine was Arab, to stop Jewish immigration and land sales, and for the Arabs to self-govern as the British and French had promised. But crucially, the Arabs refused to participate in a legislative council, which forced the British to rule the Arabs directly through a High Commissioner and a governing council appointed by him, whereas the British governed the Jews indirectly through what was called the Jewish Agency. And throughout the interwar period, there followed repeated cycles of Arab violence in 1920, 21, 29 and 33, followed by British government inquiries and attempts at reconciliation with the Arabs, followed by Zionist intransigence. So when Churchill was Secretary of State for both war and air, before he went to the colonial office, he championed the idea of air control. So Britain was short of money after the First World War. It was a period of austerity and imperial overstretch, yet had new territories in the Middle East to govern. So Churchill, with his advisors Hugh Trenchard and T. Lawrence, convinced the British cabinet to rule Iraq indirectly through an Arab king and support him with air power, because that was the cheapest way of doing it. And this policy was called air control, and it followed the 10 years rule's direction to make maximum use of mechanical contrivances to police the empire economically. But this policy was controversial. Scholars warn of learning false lessons from it. Peter Gray, one of the professors here, has written about that. But as an air staff memorandum noted, air control reduced vulnerable lines of communication, allowed better living conditions for British garrisons, and enabled Britain to retain the threat of force without occupation. And in Iraq, it used 8 squadrons of aircraft, 2 armoured car companies, locally recruited imperial levies, and a nascent Iraqi army to replace 2 British Army divisions and save about £30 million a year, which work out in 1921-22 was a lot of money. The War Office was critical, calling the policy brutal, but then army punitive expeditions were brutal as well. And the army, the Air Force argued that the short-term pain of an air raid was better than a punitive column. And in fact, most air operations in Iraq were in Kurdistan. And rather than being prescription bombing raids, they were actually joint operations with land forces. So attack, close air support, interdiction, reconnaissance, air presence, leafleting, transport, resupply, medical evacuation, and also Arabic-speaking RAF ground intelligence officers. So all the sort of things you'd see in a counterinsurgency now. And the most famous of those ground intelligence officers or special service officers, as they were called, was John Glubb, who went on to command the Arab Legion. But more recently, post-colonial scholars have been critical of the legacy of air control in Iraq, one calling it a new form of imperial rule, invisible, barely existing on paper, designed for an increasingly anti-imperialist post-war world. But this was not the case in Palestine. So when Churchill in the Colonial Office in 1922 transferred military control of Palestine to the RAF, he did so for administrative reasons, as it was recognised that semi-urban Palestine was not suitable for air policing, though the newly, the adjacent newly formed state of Transjordan, now Jordan, was. So Palestine in December 1920, there were 29,000 British and Indian troops, fit, according to Churchill, to face an army under face a German army under modern conditions. And there were many more in Mesopotamia. But as Churchill told the cabinet, "I have not the necessary machinery here in the colonial office for the exercise of direct military control. I have accordingly invited the Air Ministry, and they have accepted my invitation to act as my agents there in the same way as they do in Iraq. This does not imply that Palestine is to be controlled from the air, but merely that it is a matter of the administrative channel. And the air staff agreed that the principal sources of trouble in Palestine would be in the towns. So in the towns, the British were to rely on the Palestine police for internal security. So that was a colonial police force made up of Arabs and increasingly Jews, with British officers, initially supported by a British gendarmerie. And in 1922, that gendarmerie was about 800 men, most of whom had come from Ireland. They'd been black and tans or Royal Irish Constabulary auxiliaries. So a pretty hard bunch. And their first known experience of Arab rioting was in Nablus in October 1922, where they cleared the streets of rifle butts. And quote, in 2 minutes, the show was over, except for those lying on the floor. But they were expensive. They were paid 10 shillings a day, which is a lot of money then. And so the outgoing High Commissioner in 1925, a Jew called Herbert Samuel, Britain's first Jewish cabinet minister and party leader, reported Palestine was the most peaceful country in the Middle East. And his successor, Field Marshal Lord Plumer, for fiscal reasons and knowing that he'd get reinforcement if there was trouble, got rid of the British gendarmerie and replaced it with a British section in the Palestine police. And he also withdrew the last British regiment, a cavalry regiment, and replaced it with the Transjordan Frontier Force, a locally raised air ministry unit based in Jordan. And there are also 12 aircraft from No. 14 Squadron RAF in Jordan and a company of RAF armoured cars. The RAF had been forced to form its own armoured car companies when the War Office refused to provide them. And Palestine and Transjordan was downgraded from a RAF command to a group, and by 1929, the only internal security force consisted of the Palestine police of around 1,500 men, including Britons. So that all fell apart in 1929, when there were inter-ethnic riots, starting with Arabs killing Jews over arguments over access to the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, and the unsuitability of aircraft and armoured cars, no surprise to the Air Ministry, but their unsuitability was exposed. And so at the outbreak of the riots, Stuart Perrone, a junior government official, watched, quote, Arabs breaking stones against the windows of Jewish houses. Soon they began using guns, and at least three grenades were thrown. At last the police arrived. The British police fired a volley and the place was soon clear. Meanwhile, aeroplanes had been seen flying over the city. And these aeroplanes would have been DH-9As called Ninaks from 14 Squadron based in Amman. And so by this stage, they're at least 10 years old. They'd been used in the First World War. It's a day bomber used in the First World War. Arab policemen proved unreliable when confronted with Arab rioters. All available RAF ground personnel were sent to Jerusalem, and every able-bodied European was made a special constable, including Perrone and 30 student Anglican priests who were studying in Jerusalem at the time. But there's no record of how effective they were as special policemen. And unsurprisingly, aircraft engagements were prevented by the rule of engagement that machine gun fire will only be used when looters and incendiaries are caught in the act or when persons are caught flagrante delicato committing acts of violence. And the RAF's armoured cars were vulnerable in towns as well. So Brigadier Dobie's brigade from Cairo was sent. The first 50 infantrymen were flown in four Victoria transports, and Dobie assumed command from the group captain, Playfair. The riots since, historians have since seen the riots as a failure of air power. The historian Elizabeth Munro wrote, too much reliance had been placed on the Trenchard scheme of policing by means of the RAF, And for David Amici, the riots were a sign that air power dramatically failed to contain the growing communal conflict in Palestine. But we've already seen that the air ministry accepted that air power was unsuitable for urban conflict in Palestine. So the air ministry reminded the government of this, that air policing had never been applied to Palestine because of its recognised limitations. And in any case, the army garrison of 4,000 had not prevented the riots of 1924. Trenchard sent Air Vice Marshal Hugh Dowding to Palestine to outrank Dobie and regain Air Ministry control. And Dowding told Sir Walter Shaw's commission that cooperation between the army and the RAF had been excellent, although these NINACs were of limited use during the riots. But they had been used for reconnaissance, liaison with the French in Syria, dropping proclamations and supplies. So the Shaw Commission, like all previous inquiries, found the cause of Arab rioting was fear of Jewish immigration, land sales, and lack of self-government. And it recommended the government address these issues, but they were subsequently blocked by Zionist appeals to the Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald. Shaw also concluded that the inadequacy of the military forces and of the reliable police available was a contributing factor. And so after much consideration, the cabinet left the RAF in control, but the garrison now included two infantry battalions. The headquarters was moved from Amman to the old Fars building in Jerusalem, and the senior army officer was to have direct access to the High Commissioner. And there was also a new police commissioner, Mr. Dow Biggin, who improved police intelligence and doubled the numbers of British policemen. So we move on now to the Arab Revolt and its outbreak in 1936. Arab bitterness continued to grow towards the Mandate, caused by increased Jewish immigration as a result of oppression of the Jews in Europe, not just in Germany, but in Poland as well. Also, the weakening of the British position in the Eastern Mediterranean, vis-a-vis Italy, and the global economic depression. There was an Arab strike in 1933, and the police performed pretty well. The French in Syria linked this unrest with pan-Arab hostility to foreign rule, but the British did not. Nevertheless, the intelligence gathered by the RAF Special Service officers, the intelligence officers in Palestine, in late 1935, allowed the Air Officer Commander-in-Chief, Middle East, Air Chief Marshal Sir Robert Brooke Popham, to send a remarkably prescient report warning London that the Arabs would soon rebel. And I think this is really important, that the intelligence suggested that the rebels would not operate in towns where they realised riots can be easily suppressed, but they would operate instead in small gangs of about 20, causing trouble all over the country. So that's not only what they did, but by avoiding the police in the towns, they then became targets, as we will see, for the Royal Air Force. So perhaps it wasn't the best decision. And those of you that know about the Jewish insurgency after the Second World War, the Jews stuck to urban, didn't operate in the countryside. It's where the British were at their most vulnerable. The British must have realised this was coming, and so they made preparations. And you won't be able to read this probably, but I apologise for that. But the Air Officer Commanding, Air Vice Marshal Richard Pearce, in 1936, formed for the time a uniquely joint British Forces headquarters. So in those days, everything, it was a stovepipe from the War Office, the Air Ministry, airmen couldn't come under military command, and vice versa. Whereas Pearce established this combined staff in the St. David Hotel in Jerusalem. So he's the Air Officer Commanding. On the left there, it says Brigadier General Staff, Colonel J.F. Evetts. So his 2IC and Chief of Staff is the senior military. And if your eyesight's good enough, you'll be able to see all those staff branches are both airmen and soldiers. So the revolt kicked off with the murder of two Jews in April 36, followed by an Arab general strike, accompanied by violent disorder, sabotage, the murder. And soon those guerrilla groups, the British called them armed bands, started operating in rural areas, ambushing patrols and convoys. And unlike the previous Arab disturbances in 1920, 1921 and 1929, the British were targeted as well as the Jews, an important point for the British. And this is Evarts in later life in the 50s. He was known as Black Jack Evarts, quite a hard guy, retired as Lieutenant General. Oh, and I've missed. I've got another government now. So this is Sir Arthur Washup, I think you pronounce his name. The troops called him Washup because they thought he was useless. It's probably a bit harsh, but he'd been High Commissioner since 1930. He was a former Major General in the Black Watch, and he adopted a conciliatory political and military response to the revolt, announcing a royal commission would investigate Arab grievances once order had been restored. But he also had lots of colonial law backing up. So what he thought was conciliatory, probably we wouldn't think so today. So the curfews, searches, collective punishments, detention without trial for up to a year, forced labour and media censorship. That was conciliatory. The garrison was reinforced, 11 infantry battalions, and elements of up to 4 squadrons of light day bombers. And I think I've got those here. So 6 squadron with Harts. Sometimes they refer to Hardies. Hardy was the sort of imperial version of a Hart. It just had a different radiator and carried more water. You've got the Ferry Gordons of 14 Squadron. 33 Squadron also had Harts. 28 Squadron had Audax, which is another version of the Hart. And also you've got number 2 Armoured Car Company. So those were the British forces. The British infantry deployed defensively and just guarded things, apart from one battalion. And the RAF initially just stuck to leaflet dropping. They dropped over 200,000 leaflets on 1,000 villages. And they were, just like in 1929, they were restricted to engaging armed bands with their machine guns only. So the Hart only had one forward-firing machine gun. But British commanders were frustrated by this. Pierce, whose photo I've just clicked over, so there he is in later life commanding Bomber Command. Pierce wrote, "The armed band as a rule concentrated only for attack. In defence, it was concerned chiefly in running away to live another day. It held no ground, it had no headquarters, and no communications at which to strike. And it depended for its armour on its elusiveness." So classic guerrilla tactics. And so if the army convoys were ambushed, sleeping bouncing around, so an army patrol there. If they were ambushed, the infantry would dismount, but they lacked the numbers, the mobility and local knowledge to pursue the enemy. Whereas if aircraft protected the convoy, the Arabs wouldn't attack the convoy. So after Pierce and his senior army officer, Evarts, were ambushed themselves on a reconnaissance in May 36, they decided the best approach would be to let the guerrillas attack convoys and then call up aircraft to strike them. And it was Air Commodore Roderick Hill, who'd arrived to take over from Pierce, but hadn't yet done so, who devised the air striking force concept, as it was called, to enable convoys to quickly call in air support. So aircraft were based on dispersed landing grounds, they were held at 5 minutes ground alert, and they could reach anywhere in Palestine within 30 minutes. And as the army lacked wireless telegraphy, it was called, the RAF installed WT sets in hired lorries, which they called Rodex, I don't know why. And those lorries accompanied convoys. When the convoy was attacked, they made a call in Morse, an X-ray call, using the RAF signals network, which went direct to air headquarters. And then an air liaison section at Ramley Airfield would allocate aircraft, and the aircraft would come to the rescue of the convoy. And there's lots of other liaisons as well. RAF squadron commanders put liaison officers with infantry brigades and battalion headquarters. Military intelligence was combined under a group captain, Kenneth Buss, who was an Arabic-speaking officer. He'd been in the Middle East since 1920 when he commanded number 47 Squadron, and the RAF SSO network was expanded as well to Jaffa, Nablus, Nazareth, the Jordan Valley, as well as Jerusalem and Haifa, so all of the big towns. And increasingly, they were relied on intelligence rather than the police CID, who were viewed as unreliable. So this air striking force concept increasingly became the main method of attacking rebels as the situation worsened. So the first Rhodex patrol was on the 9th of June, the first X-ray call was on the 11th of June, although the aircraft couldn't attack the Arabs because they took refuge in caves. The first engagement was on the 20th of June, when a Flight Lieutenant Clark in a number 6 squadron, Hart, was escorting a convoy. The convoy was attacked. He made an X-ray call that could be done from aircraft as well. And 9 aircraft came to the rescue in an action that lasted until nightfall. And these are quite serious actions. The aircraft were hit a total of 13 times. 3 were forced to land, and they caused an estimated 15 enemy casualties. Immediately after this, they were allowed to drop 20-pound bombs, but not within 1,000 yards of any town or village, and only following coordination with land forces. That was soon reduced to 500 yards, and so all aircraft routinely carried 20-pound bombs. And this sort of goes on. So in July, you get more engagements. You have 15 rebels here, 4 aircraft there, killing 7 rebels here. All 4 aircraft were hit. And these calls took typically 9-10 minutes. It was 9 or 10 minutes from the call to the aircraft arriving. So we consider that to be pretty good now. In July, 6 Squadron alone responded to 13 calls and claimed to have inflicted 37 casualties. In August, 12 calls and 14 requests. That's just 6 Squadron. I've only had the capacity to go through 6 Squadron's records and not the other squadrons. And the bands increased in size, so there were soon about 2,000 of them, but they lacked modern weaponry, especially machine guns for anti-aircraft fire. But they were led by a guy called Fawzi al-Mawukji, who was a former Ottoman and caused trouble all over the Middle East. And air intelligence reported that the Arabs showed signs of effective leadership and organisation, and actions are marked by stubborn resistance. And they'd also started reprisals against the RAF. So 2 off-duty airmen were killed in Jerusalem, presumably in reprisal for the RAF's effectiveness. So this air striking force concept was not perfect, and certainly it was not without risk. So the lorries couldn't go off-road. The RAF wireless couldn't speak to the armies. The HART, which I showed you, lacked a pickup hook and had no radio. The Audax had a radio, but to use it, or a radio telegraphy, but to use it they had to trail an antenna, which was so long they couldn't fly at low level when they did so. And so, as Pierce noted in his dispatch, the pilots flew low under 500 feet to both identify the armed men and also to draw fire. So then they could see them. And then what they do is they dive bomb from 1,000 feet, drop bombs, and use a single front gun. Increasingly, as I've said, they came under fire. And so when Hart was lost and both the aircrew were killed, Pilot Officer Hunter and Aircraftsman Lincoln, in those days, the air gunner in the back was just an aircraftman taken from the line. When that happened, the rules of engagements were relaxed, and the RAF could use machine guns against houses from which people had fired at them. Then the Arabs started digging trenches, and so then the RAF were given permission to drop larger bombs in order to destroy the Arab bands in the trenches. So the situation worsened, and Pierce wanted to sort it out by using prescription bombing. He wanted to bomb Arab villages in order to coerce the Arabs to hand the ringleaders in. And he suggested this to the British cabinet. But the cabinet rejected the proposal on the 2nd September, It must have been a very interesting cabinet meeting because they also considered Hitler's occupation of the Rhineland and the Italian invasion of Abyssinia at the same one-hour meeting. But they were warned, the cabinet were warned off punitive measures by the Iraqi foreign minister, and so they ordered intensive measures should be taken designed to crush Arab resistance but should not include any bombing of the civil population. So instead they dispatched General Dill and the 1st Division to Palestine to take over. And to mobilise the 1st Division, they mobilised all of the army's high readiness reservists to do so. That's the only time that happened between the wars. Dill took over from Pierce. Pierce declined to be Dill's chief of staff, so he returned to London, and Roderick Hill became the air commander and air advisor. And the large actions continued as the reinforcements arrived. There was one where air claimed 41 out of the 50 enemy killed, and so on it went. But the threat of martial law, the imminent fruit harvest, lemon harvest, orange harvest, and a face-saving appeal by neighbouring Arab kings convinced the Palestinians to accept a royal commission and call off the strike. The RAF called off their operations, and so that was the end of the first phase of the revolt in September, October 1936. The second phase starts in September 37 and runs through until December 39. And the RAF continued to play a key role in this phase. But both sides were expecting hostilities to start again. When the Royal Commission reported, the Peel Commission, it recommended partition. The Arabs rejected it. The District Commissioner in Galilee was murdered. The British arrested the entire Arab High Committee, flew them into exile in the Seychelles, and basically decapitated the Arab leadership. The British also brought in a guy to reorganise the police called Tegart, and he reinforced the police. But what happened generally was the conflict became even more brutal. Peasant gangs took over, a bit like the Taliban. They set up their own courts, raised taxes, intimidated the urban elite who fled. The Arabs were better trained. British captured a thing which was known as the Damascus Field Service Regulations, which gave the following guidance on protection from attack. And I'll just read a couple of bits out. The best protection is to lie flat, close to natural cover, and keep absolutely still. Obviously, it was written in Arabic, not English, but this is the translation. This makes it difficult for the aeroplane to observe the gang, particularly if clothing blends in colour with the natural surroundings. And then it says, except for defence and in cases of necessity, aircraft should not be fired at. Obviously, if you fire at the aircraft, you draw attention to yourself. So the Arabs were thinking about how to protect themselves from aircraft. But basically, the garrison's reinforced again. General Wavell takes over. Bands get bigger. You get bands of 300 or 400 men. Everything just increases in size, and on it goes. And particularly vulnerable were the foot columns. They had to carry their wireless sets. When attacked, they had to stop, erect the mast, wait for London to signal traffic because there's only one there, and then make the call. So on one occasion, that took 50 minutes. And then there was a big fight, and Sergeant Coggins, a sergeant pilot of Number 6 Squadron, sergeant pilots who were just coming in again at this stage, was awarded the Distinguished Flying Medal. Meanwhile, Arthur Harris takes over from Hill as the air commander, and he's worried that the army had become ever reliant on RAF support, something again which is again common now. And this led to unnecessary aircrew casualties. So in August 1938, two aircrew were killed when the Hardy was shot down in an action which claimed to have killed 53 enemy. The largest air action of the conflict occurred in September 1938 when an Arab band of 500 men, get this, gathered for photographs, were located by the RAF, and the RAF attacked them. So attacked them with 13 aircraft from three squadrons, dropping 48 bombs and firing 6,000 machine gun rounds, claiming over 100 enemy casualties at the cost of five damaged aircraft. One aircraft was hit in 16 places. And so it goes on. There are two aircraft lost in October and one aircraft lost in a Gladiator, which have now arrived, lost in November. So Harris didn't like this. He thought the army were too quick to call in the RAF. And he devised, one of his innovations was a concept called the air pin. So to pin the Arabs down by air, which was basically to do a cordon by air. So leaflets would be dropped, the aircraft would patrol the village, anyone escaping would be assumed to be a rebel, as opposed to somebody that couldn't read the leaflet, and the army would then arrive and conduct a search. And Harris's big thing was the army struggled with their mobility. One of the ways the British Army tried to get round mobility was a chap called Major Ord Wingate formed special night squads, which were specially trained squads of British officers and soldiers and Jewish police auxiliaries, British-trained, British-armed Jewish auxiliaries. So the special night squads would go out at night and ambush the Arab gangs. And Harris thought the combination of special night squads and air was the way to go. Harris was also concerned in September 38 because half the British garrison was redeployed to Egypt as part of the British preparations during the Munich crisis. Harris reported that for at least the next fortnight we shall remain as we are now, cut to the bone for troops. The defence of Jerusalem, which is momentarily threatened with attack, is only one company of Black Watch and two half sections of my armoured cars. And there's a much quoted quote from Harris when he writes to his air officer commanding, when he says, to make up for a lack of numbers, let's make up for a lack of numbers by using rougher methods with the rebels than we dare do in peace. One 250-pound bomb or 500-pound bomb in each village that speaks out of turn within a few minutes or hours of having so spoken, or the complete blotting out of a few selected haunts for the encouragement of others. Now, that was Harris's proposal if the whole garrison left. The whole garrison never left, and Harris's proposal was never implemented. But you often see it as an example of Harris's brutality. In fact, what he did do, and I quite like this, he gave his SSOs two Mauser submachine gangster guns each to compete with the bandits dressed as Palestine police. He told his armour car crews, as the civil writ no longer runs, all the advice I can give is that when in aid of the non-existent civil power, they should fire when they must and keep on firing as long as appears militarily essential. And so what happens in September 1938, the British government, the chiefs of staff, just get fed up with Palestine. They realise actually that the threat of Japan, Germany and Italy is much more serious and they need to end the Arab revolt. So they send two divisions commanded by Montgomery and Richard O'Connor. Obviously both go on to greater fame in the Second World War. And basically the army takes over. So they take control of the district commissioners, they take control of the police. All movement is controlled and there's large-scale internment. And O'Connor himself, when he's out in the reconnaissance, he's ambushed and he says, throughout we were in wireless touch with our escorting aeroplane. As a result of an X-ray call, three more aircraft came out to our assistance. This was the normal emergency procedure, which worked very well. And the Arabs themselves fragmented. They started fighting amongst themselves. And increasingly, the Arabs were forced into Jordan. The rebels were forced into Jordan, where the RAF went after them. And 14 Squadron now equipped with Wesley bombers, and they do quite a bit of damage to the Arabs in the desert. So the revolt petered out with the government's white paper. So there's a big meeting in London called the London Conference. And so what as a result of this, there was a white paper which promised the Palestinians independence for 10 years. They would be a majority still, and so it meant that Palestine would be an Arab state. And also it would limit Jewish immigration and land sales for the next 10 years. The Jews didn't like it, but they at that stage didn't have much choice. Low-level violence continued, and what does change from 1939 onwards is you now get violence from the Jews as well as the Arabs. And that violence continues. I've looked at No. 2 Armoured Car Company's records, and they're reporting general conditions in Palestine unchanged, both Arabs and Jews giving trouble, considerable sniping done, and landmines used during the month. They have a guy killed in April 1940, just before they go to the Western Desert. So this low-level insurgency continues. So to start a fairly lengthy conclusion, so the Gladiators come into service with 33 Squadron. Harris really likes the Gladiator for close support because it's got four machine guns. So here we see, like in the First World War and like in the Second World War, the British are using fighters and not dedicated ground attack aircraft for ground attack, because they find the fighter is just as good. So the Arab Revolt represented the most severe challenge to British colonial rule since the Anglo-Irish War, which ended in 1922, and RAF air power played a key role. In each phase of the rebellion, the rebels controlled much of the countryside and some of the urban areas as well, intimidating the population in what one commentator at the time called sub-war, a psychological and political war against the government in a campaign to isolate the police from the population. Again, that sounds very modern. Britain ultimately achieved its strategic objective of retaining Palestine during the Second World War by realising the Arabs were now more strategically important than the Jews. The British wanted to keep Arab countries on side, and hence you get this white paper. But the RAF played a key role, and as we've heard already, Dill reported that when it came to striking the enemy, it was usually upon the bombs and the guns of his aircraft that the commander would rely for a concentration of force at the decisive point, to the extent that in some months air action caused more than 50% of enemy casualties operating within legal constraints. So air allowed the army mobility because it could go on patrol without integral fire support. It could risk using smaller formations in searches because of that, and it's secure, its lines of communication were secure. It is difficult, though, to assess the impact of air power on the Palestine civilians because of the lack of available sources, whether in English or Arabic. Some scholars, in particular a guy at Brunel at Uxbridge, Matthew Hughes, has extensively catalogued incidents of brutality by the British against the Arabs. So you have the collective punishments, which were legal by the mandate's legal system, but also you have unauthorised reprisals by British forces, destruction of property, some murder. Not much, but enough to worry about. And General Haining, when he took over as GOC, he must have been aware of the ill-discipline because he warned both Generals O'Connor and Montgomery that unnecessary violence, vindictiveness, which is un-British, killings in cold blood, must be thoroughly investigated and, if proved, punished in an exemplary manner. But what I have searched for is evidence of indiscriminate air attack, and I can't find any. I can't find any in British official accounts, which some would say is unsurprising. But also looking at the records of Arab complaints to the Anglican mission there, there's a large British mission which looks after lots of the Arabs, has close relations with them. There's no mention there. And there's an extensive oral history by a guy called Swedenborg, who goes in the 80s, goes and talks to loads of aged Palestinians, and they make no mention of it. So the evidence is not conclusive, but it does indicate that the RAF was not guilty of excessive force, and it did keep to those quite restrictive rules of engagement. But then it only had machine guns and fairly light bombs. And the level of air-land integration achieved gives lie to the view that there was a peak of efficiency in air-land integration in 1918, at the end of the First World War, and then that was not achieved again until the middle of the Second World War. So Hill describes how they came up with the idea in Palestine. And he says that his scheme combined the air organisation of Bethel's force, which was the advance party of British Fourth Army in November 1918, and the air defence of Great Britain, which since 1917 had used an intelligence screen and speedy communications to direct defending fighters onto enemy bombers. So he's saying this is an old idea, we've done this before. Interestingly, Hill had neither served with Bethel's force or in the London air defence area. He spent a year on the front line in 1916, and he was such a good pilot, he was creamed off and became a test pilot. But his senior air staff officer, in that diagram that I showed you, is a wing commander, DJ Stevenson, and he'd commanded No. 35 Squadron RAF, which is one of the two RAF squadrons that supported Bethel's force. And he, like other squadrons supporting 4th Army, would have used the RAF Central Information Bureau, which had been established in 1918. And what this did was it collected information on ground targets from reconnaissance aircraft by wireless, and it transmitted them to ground strafing fighters holding a cab rank above the front line using radio telegraphy, so using voice. And so, again, that looks very much like what was used in Palestine. So Hill's concept was thus a continuation from the First World War. Hill's concept also fitted with the RAF's long-standing air support doctrine, which was that the RAF would provide what they called close support of to troops in contact only in extremis, because it was dangerous. It was costly in aircraft. So the RAF's preference was to use what they called direct support, either through interdiction or indirect support through strategic bombing. So when Hill proposed his lessons identified from Palestine to the Air Ministry, at sort of staff level, group captain level, they were poorly received. And there's a group captain who sends Hill's report to Pierce, so Hill's former commander, the former air commander in Palestine, who was in charge when they came up with this idea. Peary sends it to Pierce and says, look, this is a stupid idea, which Pierce unsurprisingly disagreed with. And Pierce refers to RAF doctrine. He says there will be occasions in major war when direct support of ground forces would be desirable, and that he was arranging exercise to study the problem. And also at that time, Pierce was talking to his equivalent in the War Office. Pierce is now the Deputy Chief of the Air Staff. He's talking to his equivalent in the War Office, and they're trying to work out how the Royal Air Force is going to support the Army in 1940. And basically, it's by doing close support in extremis, preferably by doing direct support and indirect support, as they call it. And these discussions would eventually lead to the Tactical Air Forces of the Second World War. So I would argue that what they did in Palestine is both a throwback to the First World War, but also looks forward very much to the Second World War. So rather than being an outlier, it's actually just it's part of the continuity of the way the RAF intended to do things. And then meanwhile, in conclusion, British commanders in Palestine recognise that the operation's value in preparing for war. So Montgomery, whose future wartime success was based on preparation, based on training, thought, quote, "The war out here is the most magnificent training for the Army and the RAF, and we are producing seasoned fighting men second to none. The essential thing at the moment for all troops in Palestine is training in the methods of first-class war, or even," he says, "second-class war." And Harris prided himself, and again I quote from his book Bomber Offensive, that Monty, who was always only too willing to learn anything new, and he learnt at speed, got his first real understanding of air cooperation from me during his very short term of office in Palestine in 1939. So Montgomery commanded the division, but he very quickly became ill and was casavacked back to the UK. But Harris says Monty first doubted the RAF's value, but he very quickly became insistent in his request for air support. And as we've also already seen, Deal, who went on to be CRGS, also favoured the air-land integration, but noted that the Army needed more wireless sets, better inter-service understanding, particularly in troops arriving from the UK who apparently were untrained in air-land integration. And meanwhile, Harris, he's trying to use balancing his Wesley bombers to machine gun rebels in Palestine and Jordan, and also train for war against the Italians, which he knows is coming in the Eastern Mediterranean. And I've tried to look for real evidence of units that worked together in Palestine who then served together under General O'Connor in the Western Desert Force against the Italians in 1940. And the only evidence I found is 11th Hussars were in Palestine at the same time as 208 Squadron, and they routinely exchanged officers in Palestine. They became like sister units, and they most certainly operated together in the Western Desert Force. So their experience in Palestine very much helped them in the initial days in the desert. But that's, I mean, as I continue to hunt for evidence, it's quite difficult to find, but there's definitely evidence there. So that's it, that's my take on air-land integration in Palestine. Hopefully I've told you a bit about what happened, but also why it happened, where the RAF got the idea from, and also what happened next. So both countering the idea that air control didn't work in Palestine, well, it wasn't air control in Palestine, and also to counter the idea that the RAF and the Army didn't work together between the two world wars. They certainly did in the colonies. But obviously they then struggled to take that experience forward into the Second World War.